Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Vítor Vesztele, continuing his series on the cross. Today's session is number 2 and is titled Theology on the Cross, Modern Criticisms. Let's listen in.
For those who were not here in the last session, my name is Vítor Vesztele. I'm from Brazil, and I have been teaching for the last years theology at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. We have a 5-part series on the theology of the cross, which we started yesterday morning. Discussing what I call the itinerary of the cross, a brief review of the way in which the cross passes constantly through a process of domestication and of accommodation, so that it loses that which at the beginning was the distinctive mark of what the cross represented, the scandal, and the incapability of the disciples really to do something constructive out of that. But it was exactly on this scandal that the promise and the vitality of Christianity revealed itself. We are going to deal today with some criticisms to the theology of the cross as they have been raised throughout history, but mainly in the contemporary period. And I am going to try to raise basically 2 criticisms, and I would like to invite you then to try to give response to this criticism. Should we do what, for example, Asian Chinese theologian out of from Berkeley, C.S. Song, called for the abolition of the cross, so the Christians should abolish the cross even as their symbol. And in the following sessions, we are going to be dealing with the ecumenical and global aspects of the theology of the cross in the contemporary theological scene. And then the last 2 sessions, I am going to deal with the different theologies of the cross that are elaborated depending on the location that one has vis-a-vis this cross. So let's turn to what should concern us here. And as I said last time, I will try to be more intentional in asking you to intervene and to give your own opinions than I was yesterday. So I do invite you and I do encourage you any moment, just raise your hand and bring up your comments and whatever you want to say, your contributions. One of the most well-known paintings in many church circles that I have seen, and you have to imagine here because I haven't found one to show it to you, but I think it's so well-known that you might it might come to your mind very quickly, is by a Spanish surrealist painter called Salvador Dalí. Died recently. There is a painting that I have found in many church buildings, in many pastor offices, a painting of a cross that is floating on the air, a crucifix actually, that's floating on the air in a dark sky, and then a light shining upon it, and some people, Mary presumably, down kneeling and praying to this cross. I find it very ironic, in fact. Do you remember this painting? Have you seen it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find it very ironic. I was looking for it in our library at our school, and I found a little book about that painting. It was a very interesting book in which the person makes the most elaborate defense of the Christian character of that painting. He probably didn't know Salvador Dalí that well to know that this is one of the most sarcastic characters in modern art, and there was nothing but sarcasm on his part when he produced that painting. a sarcasm that reproduces itself every time that a reproduction of that painting is hanging on a church wall. And the sarcasm of it is that he wanted to raise a mirror in front of the Christians and say, listen, that's what you have made out of that cross. An event that floats above the earth, above history, above our reality, and we keep staring at it, and it doesn't touch the midst of our situation, doesn't touch the earth. It's not grounded on the earth itself. And this is the way in which Salvador Dalí found to express what for him Christianity has become. A devotion of the cross, of an idol that stands there without any connection, without any physical connection with the reality in which we are immersed. He has some other, he has at least three paintings of the crucifixion. Another one that's not so well known, it's even more dramatic. It's called a Corpus Hypercubus. There are six squared blocks floating on the air apart from each other, but in a very geometrical cross shape, and a Jesus, perfect body, floating just above, not even touching that cross, floating just above those blocks in the air, and then this beautifully dressed in white, symbolizing the church, Mary kneeling behind, and there is a chessboard on the ground, and she is kneeling on this chessboard and adoring this this Jesus. These paintings come from, it's not a coincidence, come from Spain, or Dalí was a Spanish painter, and it's not a coincidence that it comes from a country in which the devotion of the cross is extremely significant, and a devotion that we have inherited in most of Latin America due to the evangelization or the colonization or the conquest, whatever you want to call it, through the Iberian countries in Portugal and Spain. And it was out of this context that another, actually a colleague of Salvador Dalí, a poet younger than Salvador Dalí, died already, but in the 20s he wrote a poem which was not a sarcastic poem, but was a very critical, explicitly critical poem to the way in which the devotion of the cross was detached from the reality of life. And I would like to read this my own English version of this poem for you, just to introduce what I regard to be one of the central points in the criticisms that are raised against the theology of the cross, against the way in which the cross, the role that the cross plays in our own piety. The name of this poet is Antonio Machado, and he wrote in the 20s in this century, and he starts with an epigraph, which is a Spanish song, an actual Spanish popular song, sung on the streets, as I mentioned to you last time, sung on the streets, celebrating the cross during the Lent period, and people would just sing this song on the streets. The Spaniards called the saeta. And it says the following: who will lend me a ladder to get up to the cross, to pull off the nails of Jesus the Nazarene? This is the epigraph to the poem, to which Antonio Machado answers saying the following: oh, this song that sings to the cries of the gypsies, always with blood in his hands, always waiting to be released. song from my people of Andalusia, who in every spring goes out asking for ladders to climb up the cross. Song of my land that throws flowers to the Jesus of agony and is the faith of my elders. Oh, that's not my song. I don't want and will not sing to this Jesus of the cross, but only to the one who walked over water. The most central symbol of Christianity has become often an idol of devotion, dissociated from our everyday experience. And the reason of this dissociation, I have already pointed to last time, the reason of this dissociation has to do with the fact that the cross has lost its earthly character, the scandalous character of a political rebel condemned by the Roman Empire and killed by order of the Roman Empire, as thousands of other people have been also killed, being accused of subversion to the political order. I mentioned also to you last time that the first Christians didn't find any meaning on that. The only thing that they could say to that cross was either that it is the fate of someone who lives a life the way in which Jesus has lived. The true prophet is killed. It's Stephen talking, right? In Acts 5. Or it's 5 or 7. Forgot now. But the speech of Stephen before he was stoned, right? Yeah. The true prophet is killed. Who are the prophets that your ancestors haven't killed? And now you have killed the just one. So that's the fate of the true prophet. You know the true prophet by persecution, by being killed. He's quoting Nehemiah 9. Right? That's how you know who the true prophet is. So that was one of the response. The other response was simply to say, well, that's the way in which God wanted it to be. We cannot find any meaning for that. The Son of Man, or the Son of Humanity, has to be delivered to the hands of man, or to the hands of humanity. So these were the two ways in which they were trying to come to terms with that. And we have seen as the decades pass, in the first century already, we start to find some attempts at addressing the question, what is the meaning of that? And by meaning, I mean what is accomplished, what is for me on that cross. The centuries that followed frequently got stuck in this question, asking, what benefit can I get out of that cross? Meaning, what is the salvific effect of that cross? There are two main ways in which I just wanna review them to you briefly. There are two main ways that this question was answered, and I'm going to suggest to you later on that we might have a problem with the question itself. We might have started off with the wrong question, and I think that's what the criticism that we have heard in Machado's poem and in the contemporary criticisms to the cross as well. So two main traditions have attempted to address this question. What is it for me there? What advantage do I get out of that event? How does it help me? What meaning does it have for my life? And I think you're going to recognize that in your own in the practice, in your own spirituality, the spirituality of the churches in which we participate. The first one is a more conservative one. It says that the cross is the way by which God finally discovered or figured out how to reconcile two things that God had not been able to figure out how to reconcile before. That means God's love and God's justice. God wants to love the world. That's assumed, that's taken for granted. God wants to love the world. But this world, this is the presupposition that goes behind this. And I think you're going to recognize some of this, even if you remember some of the stories that you have heard about Jesus' passion. God wants to reconcile the world to God's self. The problem with that is that this world is rebellious, right? Is rebellious and has broken the law that God has established, which is normally called the fall, right? So the world has rebelled against God, has defied the law that God has given, and God, as a righteous king, cannot even betray, for the sake of his own love, the law that God has given. So humanity is guilty to hell. There is no way out, because we have not been able to be to God what God has expected us to be. We rebelled against God. So we are always in a deficit over against God. There is a debt there. There is a debt that cannot be paid, and God cannot forgive us if we're not going to be able to pay back. And we are not going to be able to pay back, because in addition to the fact that we have rebelled, we have fallen, we are also, whatever we can give to God is nothing but less, that's the point, than what God has already given to us. All that we have is God's. So that's the rationale behind. It's a very juridical concept that has framed this understanding of what's the meaning of the cross. And here comes the cross. So that for God's justice to be satisfied, someone will have to pay the debt that humanity is not being able to pay because of our fallen status. So that what God does, in order to be able to reconcile God's love with God's justice, God sends God's own Son, the only begotten Son, the one who has not fallen, the one who is sinless, to the world to be killed as a sacrifice for our sin. You have heard, and probably you have also seen, he died and paid our debt, right? So this is behind this songs, these hymns, you find this conception very much alive. So the one who has no blame, the one who is not defiled, this one has to die in order to pay the debt that the rest of us all have. And in that moment in which the cross is the final payment for the fault that we have committed, our debt is canceled, and God finally is able to reconcile God's justice with God's love. This is in a crude and rather oversimplified way the way in which this piety around the cross as the sacrifice by which our debt is being paid is normally being being framed. The result of that, what benefit does it bring to me, is exactly that. It relieves me from being condemned to an eternal hell, to an eternal fire. Does it change anything in my life? No, not necessarily. It's not connected with my life, because this is the other side of the story. I still remain personally, a fallen creature under the condemnation of that law. The only thing is that this doesn't count anymore as far as God's concerned. But my life is going to be lived in the way in which it has been lived until now, and no change is implied in this meaning that the cross has. This is what Salvador Dalí meant by this cross hanging on the air, in this ethereal realm, in which everything is resolved and God reconciles God's justice with God's love. Down here, life continues the same. In other words, salvation doesn't have anything to do with human emancipation, doesn't have anything to do with human liberation. It's something that we know as a pie in the sky, right? Something that it's not connected with our daily reality. So it's not connected with the way in which things are in the world. What's the problem with this model? It's really rather ingenious, isn't it? Because it has a logic. It has almost an iron logic to it that you can say, well, it really makes sense. So I might not like it, but it really makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Who was it who said the phrase that is the divine child abuse?
Rita Nakashima Brooke. Yeah, right.
It's inconceivable.
Yeah, this is one of the main, the sharpest criticism to this model was raised by feminist theologian as Rita Nakashima Brooke as the cosmic child abuser, the God as a cosmic child abuser. Actually, it's a nice way of putting a criticism that was raised already at the time in which this theory was elaborated. It was full-fledged elaborated around the 12th century. And at that time, a theologian called Abelard raised a very interesting question to this person who elaborated this theory that I was just briefly presenting to you, who was called Anselm, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And Abelard just asked him, okay, and now explain me, if for the human fall, which was something relatively minor in what happens, such a big sacrifice had to be rendered that the Son of God had to die, who is going to pay for that crime now? Who is going to pay for the crime of killing the Son of God? So he really took the argument from inside and turned it around and said, well, it really doesn't make any sense. If you need to go in this juridical scheme, then go all the way, and if you are going to end in an ever-increasing process of sacrifice and sacrifice and more sacrifice, which is actually one of the results of this model. Well, we need to sacrifice ourselves. We need to give ourselves up. So that's what that's one of the criticisms that were raised. Anyone could also point to something else? Yes, Mary?
You don't need the resurrection.
Right. Right. Everything is accomplished on the event itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, if God needs Jesus to die in payment to forgive us for our sins, then how can God ask us to forgive others without some payment for it? We're supposed to freely forgive people for any what they've done to us. But God can't really do that. He needs a payment for this. And how are we supposed to do something that God can't do?
Right. I think the part of this is the criticism that that the other model also that I'm going to present to you briefly also raises. It's irrelevant for what we do, right? Mm-hmm. It's rather irrelevant for what we really do. So we can go either way. It doesn't make any difference. The debt is being paid, independent from what we, from what our actions are, and independent from what we are trying to, or the way in which we are responding to God. We have just accepted the payment.
It also negates the relationship between us and Christ and says that there's no meaning to that, the way I'm seeing it.
It makes the relationship to be this kind of ethereal relationship like Dalí presented, right? It's Christ is no longer
the one. There's a separation. There's still not a
relationship. Yeah, it was not a crime that happened there because a political subversive was killed in a cross and condemned because of that cross. Dan?
Well, it's similar to that. It seems to me just to erase the significance about how Jesus chose to live. I mean, his life and ministry and the significance of those acts, if it all gets reduced to an act of divine sacrifice, then the significance of how he lived and the choices he made get negated.
Fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the basic issues that's at stake in this. In this theory, is that the event of the cross is not only separated from the resurrection, as Mary pointed out, but also from the life of Jesus. So no matter what Jesus did, the cross was an accident. It could have been anything. There's one theologian in this century called Rudolf Bultmann who said that the death of Christ in the cross was a misunderstanding. It had to, from a human perspective, was a misunderstanding, right? So it was not connected with his life. So Pilate really didn't figure out well what to do with Jesus, so allowed him to be killed was a mistake of justice. But through that, God accomplishes something. So it's a rupture in the relationship between what Jesus did and the consequence of that, which is rather the opposite of what I was explaining the opposite of what the first disciples thought about the cross of Jesus. They even said, well, there is no meaning in it, but it had to be so, because someone who lived like that would end like that, right? So they made a very strong connection, even to the point of surrendering the question or not asking the question, what does it do for me? Right. The second, moving along here, the second theory tries to address this questions that we have been asking. It really almost inverts the approach. And it says that the meaning of the cross is not in what God is doing to Jesus or to God's Son. It's not something that needs to be done in order for God's justice to be satisfied. What kind of a God is that cannot love without fulfilling whatever human understanding of justice really is? But it says that the cross of Christ is tied and linked to Jesus' life and is given to us as an example to be followed if we want to really do God's will. Jesus is the one who did God's will. The cross exemplifies the consequences of that. I'm reminded Dan used yesterday, I think it was Dan Berrigan, Dan? Yeah, if you want to follow Christ, you better good look.
Good on wood.
Yeah, look good on wood, yeah. So this is part of this interpretation. The cross of Christ teaches us in a form of an example of how we should live our lives. So that this suffering is not a suffering that's done in order to satisfy, but it's a suffering in consequence of the way in which we are going to follow Jesus. We are going to end up having to look good on wood. So this has been a common interpretation, and I think you can recognize that. Follow, take your cross, right? The consequence of what a truly righteous life is implies suffering, implies persecution, implies pain, implies that cross. Right? This has been a very common interpretation, and I think you must be also familiar with that in most of liberal Christianity in modern times. It means that whatever we do ought to follow this example of Jesus with the consequences that it might bring to us. But the cross then serves as a sort of an affirmation that the cause that we were defending really is a just cause, is a righteous cause. So this is a much more, one would say, much more palatable option among those that between these two that I am presenting, and I'm simplifying it. There are some variations in each one of this, but this one, even if it's more palatable for our own sensitivities or sensibilities, it still has been sharply criticized. And who would try to guess what the criticisms or suggest what the criticisms to this type of interpretation of what the cross means would be?
It has a public relations problem.
Good. Say more.
Well, it's not exactly the banner you'd run up first if you're trying to convince someone of a way of life.
Yeah, it doesn't help the enlightened self-interest. Yeah, right. It's not a pragmatic approach to it, right? But well, that could be a merit that it has, and not a problem, right?
Well, we could preach it at a masochist convention or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Justifies all kinds of human domination.
Say more, Chris.
I think, like, you get that kind of justification of suffering, and so it's okay to have people suffering, and then we can just let it be and let the systems that make people oppress people and keep people in a certain place okay, because that's, you know, blessed are those who suffer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cynical theory in the end. It says, well, that's just what we could expect, isn't it? And mm-hmm. I think I have to stop my camera. I can't go on.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes in the direction of what people are raising against it. It's a criticism that comes really out of the other criticism in modern times is the criticism of that previous model that I was presenting was very popular in in modern times since the Enlightenment, in which he said, well, a God of love cannot be one that rules by an iron rule of justice. Carry the justice to the extreme is the extreme of injustice, right? So the Enlightenment said, well, if God is the God of love, compassion is the last word. If you have seen Jesus Christ Superstar, have you seen the movie or the play, if you had a chance, there is one scene that really represents that. The final judgment, I want to talk about the final judgment later on, but the final judgment in which the sheep are separated from the goats, remember that, Matthew 25, right? And this is a nice version of a theory that tries to criticize the first model that I presented. Jesus separates, the Lord comes and separates the two of them, and then invites the ones on the right to come and join him, and then he looks back and says, well, come you too, right? And so that this love would not be, would not, in the last moment, would not have to be limited by whatever concept of justice would be concerned. But the second is, the criticism to the second comes out probably one of the sharpest criticisms that Christianity has received in modern times, and is not that Christianity is not a religion of love or anything like that. It can even be, but it's a religion of defeatists, of people that accept defeat. This is most well known by a philosopher called Nietzsche. He says that Christianity is a religion of slaves. You accept the suffering, and you even look for this suffering because you don't believe that you can overcome it. Many feminist critics have that follow this line of arguments and have pointed out to the fact that those people, those persons that are already outside of the centers of power or on the margin of the centers of power, that don't have anything else to lose, they cannot find any meaning in being preached to that they should relinquish even more of what they are. They cannot find any meaning in saying, well, the suffering is really the way in which I am paying what I am showing my own witness. No, I have to overcome it. I have to conquer the center. I have to affirm myself instead of accepting the suffering that comes. Yes, Dan?
Well, I'm not sure that... I think what Berrigan's quote might be somewhat different sense, because I hear that more as being realistic about the powers of the principalities and powers, and that if you're going to follow Jesus in the way of justice, there is going to be a cost that comes with that. I mean, that witness will not be taken lightly, and there'll be a price paid both for the individual and the community. And that when Mark, in the Gospel of Mark, says, count the cost of discipleship before you follow me, it's not a defeatism, it's not a masochistic seeking after suffering. It's saying that if you struggle for the new creation, if you struggle for the kingdom of God, it won't be taken lightly by the powers in this world, and there will be a cost to be paid. And I think that's very realistic, and I think that that's been very insightful for many oppressed communities that struggle, know that all too well. That when they organize and when they struggle, there's a cost that comes with it. But the witness there is that that's not the final cost. I mean, that there is something beyond that that holds it together. So that may be a different way than the one that you're, the atonement theory that you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think it's I think the difference then is the way in which you are approaching the question of what is this suffering. Mm-hmm. The question that you ask is not, and this the criticism is, the criticism starts from the question, what is the meaning of the suffering? Can we find a meaning in that suffering. While I think what you are saying is to say, well, I want to see in that suffering what I can find, who I can find in that suffering. And in this sense, yes, there is a cost to be paid, but the question is a different one. It doesn't suppose that from the beginning on, I am going to find a meaning in suffering itself. But that's the criticism that's being done. Dorothea Zille, the German feminist theologian, said that she has a nice way of putting it. It said, well, suffering doesn't have any meaning. It really doesn't have any meaning except when it's a suffering to overcome suffering, to fight against suffering. So this is the theories of atonement. They all start, or of reconciliation, or whatever you might want to call it, of salvation. They always start from this question: what meaning can I find in that cross, right? And out of that, then comes you can have a more progressive, like the second one, or a more conservative one, like the first one that I described. But they presuppose the same thing. And by presupposing the same thing, by presupposing the same question, that I start from here, that I start from, it must have a meaning. Then I am going to try either finding this cosmic child abuser, right? That's what I'm going to end up. Or then I'm going to find masochism, really. Masochism. And say, well, I have to find it. If it doesn't come to me, I have to find it in some way.
It seems like it's making the wrong thing the object, the subject.
Exactly.
Of faith.
Mm-hmm. Very good, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Because The way in which this suffering, the experience of suffering, affects the people that are not at the center, but that live at the margin itself, is not the objective that they want to conquer. It's not the objective toward which they want to go, but it's the consequence through which they pass. So this is the reason why we even find reactions, very strong reactions, against any suggestion that the cross in itself could even remain as a symbol of Christianity because of the abuse to which it has been subjected or has been submitted. C.S. Song, as I mentioned, he calls for the abolition of the cross. He says, well, it's helpless. We have done so much damage with it. Reminds me, by the way, a poem by an Inca Indian from the 17th century, Poma Ayala. He has a very little poem. It says, I climbed up to the top of the mountain. There I saw a cross, and I began to cry. And if you know the whole story of the way in which the cross came with the sword to Latin America, you can imagine what lies behind that poem. Right then I saw a cross and I began to cry. So due to that, C.S. Song says, well, we need to abolish it. It's really, we need to work toward a Christianity that doesn't need that symbol anymore. It's irretrievable. A student of mine did some work in an African-American church, in a black church, in Detroit, I think it was in Detroit, if I remember correctly, and she brought a picture of one of the of a stained glass that was just created for that church, and was designed by the pastor of that church. I don't know, Jody Youngblood, does this say anything to you, pastor?
He's in New York, I think. Johnny Ray Youngblood.
I think that's the first name.
Yeah, could well be. He's in Brooklyn, in New York.
Yeah, that could be New York. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in any case, he has this stained glass that he ordered. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Yeah, and the stained glass that comes an African American, strong Jesus. with the shackles broken from his arms, right? And almost in a almost like in a karate kick, he's kicking the cross and splitting the cross, throwing the cross. And on the black, on the back, there is a rising sun, and on the one side, the empty tomb, the affirmation of the resurrection, right? Affirmation of the resurrection. We don't want that cross. That cross has been used in one way or another in order to say, well, if you have been slaves, it might be not very good for you, but it's the way of the Lord. It's the way in which Jesus was there. Howard Thurman, I think, is the this sort of dean of the African American black theology. He was a chaplain in Harvard in the big first part of this century. In the 30s, right? It was about the 30s, right? He has a beautiful story in his autobiography. He tells that he grew up thinking that there were two Bibles, and only when he was an adult, he learned that it was only one Bible, because his mother read to him every day the stories of Jesus, the parables and the miracles of Jesus. And every weekend, when they that was in a, as a slave in a farm still, and every weekend when the preacher would come, he would read from Paul's theology of the cross, right? From Paul's theology. And he always thought that the Bible of the preacher was one and the Bible of his mother was was another. So within this background, you can imagine what this this represent of people trying to find life. I don't want this Jesus of agony, right? Like Machado says, I want rather the one who walked over water. So this is what is being, is being searched. Well, my question really is where do we go from? Where do we go from here? Is there something retrievable in the cross, in the symbol of the cross, and in the theology of the cross, or not? A middle ground solution was offered by theologian Douglas John Hall from Canada. Douglas John Hall has the following way of dealing with that. He says, well, yes, both sides are right. Those who say that the cross really has some meaning in the sense of in the sense of affirming the consequences of being of being disciples of Jesus, as much as those who try to break away with this word of suffering and affirming life, affirming the resurrection, affirming the walking over water. He said, depending on the public. And he said, for the thieves, we need the theology of the cross. For those who have fallen among the thieves, that does not help. And so that's that was his suggestion, and saying, depending on the public, you choose the theology. No, really, he said that these were exactly his words. So he makes a theology of the cross selective, and he is one of the most important articulators of a theology of the cross. He's known for that in the North American scene. But he makes very clear restrictions. Says, well, I don't know what to say about the cross for people that have lived with the cross. The last two sessions, I am going to try to reflect with you on the question of the relationship between the location toward the cross and the different voices that the theology of the cross will have depending on the relationship that we have this theology. And I will use some biblical imagery to frame that. But just coming back to the point that I was raising at the beginning, and in reaction to Dan's comment as well, the point that we need to be attentive to in discussing the theology of the cross, and here is where I want to lead open some space for further discussion from here on, is that the question has been falsely put. Suffering has no meaning. But it might have a future. It might have a future. So to ask at the beginning, at the starting point, as all theories of atonement or of reconciliation, for the meaning of a suffering or for the meaning of the cross, I think sets us on the wrong track. And I think that has been the basic problem or the basic difficulty that that the theology of the cross, the reflection about the cross or whatever, has normally had. What is the starting point then, and why might the cross receive some importance still, and why we might not want or might not even be allowed to abolish it? Let me start with, let me just give you one example, the one that I gave in connection with Jesus Christ Superstar before. Matthew 25. It's the story of the Great Judgment. You're familiar with that, right? Everyone knows the story, right? The day of the Lord, the day of judgment, Jesus comes again to judge, and he is going to come to some people and say, well, I have been naked and you didn't dress me. I have been thirsty and you didn't give me to drink. I have been hungry and you didn't feed me. I was in prison and you didn't visit me. What was their reaction?
When were you?
What's that? Surprise, right? Mm-hmm. Surprise. Okay, he goes to other people and say, well, come in, because when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was naked, you dressed me, and so on and so forth. What was their response?
Surprise.
Where are the Christians?
All over the mass.
On these two groups.
Mm-hmm. Both sides.
They're on both sides.
Yeah. Or maybe on none of them. The point of the parable, as I am interpreting it, the point of the parable is not only to say, well, what you have done or what you have not done. The point of the parable is to say to us, you have not recognized in either case. Once, because if they would have recognized, if they would have known, they would have acted like that, right? That's what they said. Oh, if we knew it where you are, we would feed you and we would visit you in jail. But sorry, no one told us that it was you, right? And on the other side, we said, well, we didn't know it was you. We did it because you were hungry. That's the reason why we did it, right? Because you were in jail, because you were thirsty, and so forth. I think this story is this parable of the judgment, of the last judgment, is significant in connection to the theology of the cross, because it points exactly to something that lies on the shoulders of Christians that we need to realize quite clearly. Christians won't have surprise as an excuse. That's the point. Christians won't have the surprise even as an excuse. We already know who Jesus is, right? Isn't this the point that Jesus wants to drive us to? You have already lived with me. You have already known my stories. You have already known who you should follow and how you should live your life. So you won't have an excuse. You cannot say, oh, we didn't know it was you. And we are not going to be surprised when Jesus will tell us, well, we were in jail, we were being tortured, we were being persecuted, we were poor, we were in debt and whatever, but we knew that that's where Jesus was. So the point of this parable is just to set the question or the meaning of the cross in a different way. It's not, let me rephrase this, it's not really the question of the meaning of the cross, but it's the question of knowing who is on this cross. In other words, the theology of the cross is not a theology that speaks about our salvation. It speaks about God's presence, where God works God's salvation. This is a different way of, phrasing the issue. That is not something that happened there that has a meaning for me, that is salvific for me, but something that's being revealed to me. So it's not because of that which happened on that cross that salvation is imparted upon me, but it's because I am allowed to see where God manifests God's own creative and salvific power. It is from the cross, from the suffering, from the situation in which people are deprived. It is on the midst of this reality that God's salvation starts to take shape, that liberation starts to take shape, that people start to raise themselves. So that's what I think is the crucial point that needs to be emphasized, that the cross signalizes the point where creation, God's creation, it starts. The point where the promise of the resurrection is going to be made manifest. It's not on Herod's castle and not on Pilate's palace. It's on the margin of Jerusalem. There you are to look. And we are going to see that this is what made the difference between the women who were able to see that first and the other disciples that went away from that cross. So the question of the cross is not what it does, but the way in which it allows us to look at where God is really working. Have any questions?
Well, there's a painting, I don't know who has done it, where you look down on the cross and Jesus on the cross, and it's God's power that's resurrecting Jesus and the world is underneath it. And there's a church in Bellevue that I love that the cross is a bronze Christ flamed up. It's not a cross of defeat, it's a cross of resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm not making connection. I'm not getting it.
Are you just saying that the cross is revelation? Isn't that?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right. That it's a revelatory act, so it's no different than a whole host of other, but there's a litany of mighty acts that we relate to as a people of God. It's the Red Sea, it's creation, it's part of revelation.
Mm-hmm.
We can't see it as a fact in history, we can only see it as a fact of, relationship.
I think we do that. You simply can't divorce it from history.
Part is from the relationship.
How can you throw off the historical act?
You can't, because the next act that happened is the splitting of the curtain in the Holy of Holies, which symbolized that we can go straight to God and we don't have to go through anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But that part of the world, that part of the world is all over with. There's a new order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the difference, I think, is that whatever this new order is not given as something that is mechanically accomplished to this event of the cross itself, but it is through the event of the cross that we are pointed to where God is working. So Luther put it nicely when he said that God can be known only in the cross and in suffering, right? Only in the cross and in suffering.
I can't.
And say more.
I can't take that. I mean, I don't agree. Uh-huh. Excuse me, Martin. I guess what I'm struggling with is the idea that we're trying to see everything that Jesus was in light of the cross. And I want to back up and listen to what, when he was talking about when you didn't feed me, when you didn't comfort me, when you didn't visit me, the cross had not happened as a literal physical event. It was happening all the time, we know, because mm-hmm. of the sacrifices that were being made.
Mm-hmm.
The cross happened when the upside down message, when the overturning message hit the world power. That's what happened. It was a consequence of the message of love hitting the power, in hierarchical power. It sounds to me like we're trying to put the cross down in history first and then arrange everything else that we believe or has occurred around that. And I can't see that. I have to see first mm-hmm. what his life was and what it was witnessing to. He didn't say, I am as the person in jail or as the person who's hungry. I am.
Exactly.
That's me. Well, that's the revolution that demanded the world's response mm-hmm. of the cross. I'm not explaining this very well. I can't start there.
Why isn't, when I said that it was intentionally said, in cross and in suffering, right? In cross and in suffering.
Only
not isolated. No, only in cross and in suffering.
Can we see God's?
Yes. Only in cross and in suffering. Because I think the point is not to isolate, it's exactly not to isolate the event of the cross itself from the crosses that we carried and then Jesus himself mm-hmm. carried. Mm-hmm. So it's not one the cross of 30, of whenever that happened, of 33, right? But the way in which that culminates a life in which several crosses have been piled up. So no, in no sense, and I think, I do agree with you, there are a lot of problems in many ways in which Luther deals with this issue, particularly in the bondage of the will, in which he really clearly starts from the question, what does it mean really to me, instead of asking who do I see in that suffering? Do I see God there? Do I see? And so that's the question that was being that's really being placed here, not separating the life, but recognizing exactly in the moment. In the moment of suffering, the moment of persecution, in the moment of hunger, in the moment of oppression, that there is the point in which God's power reveals itself. Well, we are beyond our time, and I was sorry about that. I was told that we should stop 1 hour. But we can still stop the session, right? Or we can still talk, whoever wants to. And next time we should, tomorrow, we should continue this discussion about the significance of the relationship between the cross of Christ and the suffering in the world, and in the next sessions, to deal with the question of our relationship to cross and suffering. Thank you. Mm-hmm.